you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is James Perloff. James is the author of several books, including The Shadows of Power and Truth is a Lonely Warrior. His website is jamesperloff.com. James, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good, and I want to thank you so much for having me once again as a guest on Our Interesting Times.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Now, tonight I wanted to discuss, you posted an article recently, Revisiting the Vietnam Era, or Soros and the Deep State updating an old PSYOP to depose Trump. So you analyze, I guess, the very young Trump administration, some of the decisions he has taken, the post in his administration that he has filled with some interesting characters, and some say usual suspects, but some of the actions he's taken, and also the apparent war on Trump by the mainstream media and the Deep State, and how it relates to maybe some of the experiences in the 1960s with COINTELPRO and Operation Chaos and some of the shenanigans back then to delegitimize the anti-war movement, the left, and steer the country in a certain direction. Go right ahead. What do you have to say about this? Go ahead, your article and all that. So what do you think's going on?
Well, I mentioned at the top of the article that I was originally planning to write a post called something like, "Is Trump the Real Deal or Not?" And I have to tell you honestly, Timothy, that I'm still in a jury is out on mode on Trump regarding this. You know, there are positives and negatives. And, you know, there's people in alternative media who are absolutely convinced that in our world of real politics, nobody ever gets to the top unless they have the approval of the deep state. And they think you're an absolute fool if you think that Trump could be for real. On the other hand, as you know, there's a lot of patriots and also some people who are pretty up to speed in alternative media who do like what they see in Trump. And some of the things I do like that I see in Trump, he's called out alternative media, which we've been doing for years. He has asked Robert F. Kennedy if he would participate in a vaccine task force. This is very encouraging to me because when did you ever see a major presidential candidate talk about the dangers of vaccines before? That's been pretty much off limits, certainly for mainstream media. and only we in alt media talk about it. And he's also axed the TPP. And, you know, there was a big fight in alt media to stop that thing. And I think we should be pretty happy that he has nixed that. He's also reversed the transgender policies of Barack Obama. And, you know, you look at these things and you say, these are some very good signs we're seeing from Donald Trump. And how can you be against something that's good? You know, on the other hand, some people have had complaints about the fact that, you know, after railing against the swamp, he's appointed some swamp people like Steve Mnuchin, who's an old, whose ties go back not only to Goldman Sachs, but to George Soros himself as Secretary of the Treasury. And he's got an Exxon Mobil man there. Some people have said that he was not as, even though that's a Exxon Mobil is the descendant of John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil. He was opposed to some of the Rockefeller policies there. He's looks like he's not going to investigate Hillary, which a lot of people were hoping he was going to do. And I think what troubles me the most, and we don't have to get into this right away, is he has a long connection to Zionist forces. In fact, I was doing a show with Kevin Barrett yesterday, and he was talking about his connections to Roy Cohn. And Barrett described Roy Cohn as a more powerful man in New York than I'd realized, if Kevin is correct. But there's his antipathy towards Iran, which came on very quickly after his presidency, and some of the things that happened at his inauguration, just make me a little nervous that we might be headed to the possibility of another Middle East war and unwarranted continued support for the Zionist state of Israel. So there's good and bad. I think the jury is still out. One thing I said in my post was that one thing you can't deny is that the mainstream media is in a continuous assault against him. And another thing we're seeing is this national divide. And, you know, you were alluding to earlier, I have a history going back. I was a hippie back in 1970. And, you know, I took part in the beginnings of the May Day protests in 1971 in Washington, D.C., and I was certainly not a leader. I was just a hanger on, you know. But what I'm seeing today with these protests, you know, and we didn't see any protests when George Bush was president or when Obama was president. We didn't see anybody going out and trashing cars and stuff. But all of a sudden, you see these organized riots, which are apparently going to get worse this spring. They're just waiting for the weather to warm up. And so what I wrote about in the article, I started out talking about Trump. And then I said, we're going to digress now and look at what happened in the 60s. And then we swing back and finish up with Trump after looking back at what happened with the whole counterculture, which unbeknownst to me at the time was very much an orchestrated phenomena in American culture.
Yes. What we're seeing now, what some people are referring to some of the actions against the Trump administration as a purple revolution. Mm-hmm. Those are the colors that both Bill and Hillary chose to wear the night that, I guess it was the night or the day after, because she didn't appear the night. Mm-hmm. She didn't concede. I guess it was the day after, but they were both wearing purple when they were conceding and calling for reconciliation. Of course, the suggestion there being that that's the combination of both purple and red. I mean, blue and red, rather. So you get mm-hmm. purple, and this is another stage of you know these color revolutions that have been carried out abroad on, by the CIA or CIA fronts like NGOs, USAID, or National Endowment for Democracy, which is created to do the job that the CIA used to do. I think that's how someone referred to it. But you see that in the protests, even the violence in Ukraine or in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Even Myanmar, we've seen, of course, some more violent civil wars that have been fomented by the Western powers in Libya and also in Syria.
Right.
It would be a little naive to think that some it wouldn't be applied domestically to manipulate the domestic political situation, because, you know, if the CIA is active 190 countries around the globe, 193 countries around the globe, I think the 194th country it's active in is the United States.
Absolutely.
You know, but we're, you know, obviously, I think in the article you mentioned things like Ferguson, which I think $33 million or something in Soros money, Open Society Fund, or at least some adjunct of that was spent down there organizing the protesters, that which was, you know, it wasn't organic, it was a completely made up issue in not Ferguson, but in, I'm thinking Missouri State is another case where there was, you know, this a fake. Ferguson was, I guess, involved the police shooting down there, which was.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you have other situations like Baltimore or this most recent protest out in Berkeley. In, was it February?
Yes, very violent. And there was a women's march prior to that.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was, right after the election, you had all these Not My President marches, and Soros has been linked to funding all of them.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this type of manipulation, cultural manipulation, or you know, manipulation of public opinion, or at least the creation of public opinion just through the appearances. I mean, this is the people participating in these protests hardly represent the American people. They're just a very small, tiny minority. But it gets, you know, like in the 1960s, it gets all the attention, and this has a, you know, an effect on people who are witnessing it, whether it's directly or reading about it or watching it on the news, which is probably the primary target in these things. It's the majority that they want to affect. You know, mm-hmm. not just because the protests don't really get anything done politically. It's just it's theater. You know, but in your article, you cite some specifics about sort of the '60s culture creation, whether it's what Dave McGowan wrote about in the weird scenes from the Canyon, Lower Canyon, how, you know, I guess entertainment, or in this case, rock music, popular music was in a sense weaponized to divide. The generations. That was the first time that I think the 50s and 60s, you saw the first time that different generations listened to different music. You saw a little bit with jazz, I think, which also had connections to intelligence way back in the 20s with the facilitating the heroin, promoting heroin and things like that. So it's a long record of this sort of thing. But you write about this and entertainment in general. So, so do you want to get into that a little bit? What happened? Before we get into the protest, which is kind of obvious, but the more subtle, which is the culture creation through popular music and entertainment.
Uh-huh. And one thing I like about you very much, Timothy, is your well-versed understanding of the history of American culture. I always learn things from you when I'm on your show. But I've been getting a sense of deja vu of my youth. You know, I lived in a hippie house when I was 18 years old and got immersed in that culture back starting 1970 for me. I graduated from high school in 1969. But one of the parallels that I'm getting in this deja vu is, you know, Soros is funding these riots, a billionaire. And it's quite interesting that if you go back to the counterculture and the riots back then, they were also billionaire funded. Now, it wasn't Soros back then. It was the Rockefellers, but I just want to bring a couple of quotes first, and then I'm going to talk about a little about personal experience. This first quote is from James Koonin in his, I believe it was 1968, his book, The Strawberry Statement, Notes of a College Revolutionary. And actually just describing the 1968 annual meeting of Students for Democratic Society, SDS. And they were like the leaders, the student leaders of the protest movement. In fact, I remember in my senior year in high school, there were SDS guys who were allowed to come to our campus to talk to us. In any event, quoting Koonin, he's talking about this annual meeting of the SDS, quote, "Also at the convention, men from Business International roundtables, the meeting sponsored by Business International, tried to buy up a few radicals. These men are the world's leading industrialists, and they convene to decide how our lives are going to go. They are the left wing of the ruling class. They offered to finance our demonstrations in Chicago. We were also offered SO Rockefeller money. They want us to make a lot of radical commotion so they can look more in the center as they move to the left," unquote. And I'm going to give you one more quote. This is from Jerry Kirk, who had been a member of SDS as well as the Communist Party. And this is what he testified before Congress, quote, young people have no conception of the conspiracy strategy of pressure from above and pressure from below. They have no idea that they're playing into the hands of the establishment they claim to hate. The radicals think they're fighting the forces of the super rich like Rockefeller and Ford, and they don't realize that it's precisely such forces which are behind their own revolution, financing it and using it for their own purposes, unquote. Now, in my article, I then started to reminisce about something that ties into this from my youth. Summer of 70, I worked, you know, different odd jobs, minimum wage, but I also hawked a brand new counterculture newspaper in Boston. It's called the Boston Phoenix. And they gave you a pretty good deal. I can't remember the percentage, but I think you got to keep 75% of what you made off selling the paper. I mean, they were very eager to get this left-wing message out into the streets. So I hawked that newspaper, and eventually the hippies got dissatisfied with the Phoenix because it went too commercial. It combined with another paper called Boston After Dark, and it started looking too commercial, so that the more left-wing members of their staff started their own paper. It was called The Real Paper, and the significance of that name was that if you want to get the real left-wing scoop, if you want to get the real hippie news, you read The Real Paper. But here's the catch. The owner and publisher of The Real Paper was David Rockefeller Jr., and his name was on the masthead. And, you know, I looked at that and I said, well, this David Jr. he must be rebelling against his conservative capitalist father, because that's the kind of terms we thought of in those days. We didn't realize that there was this nexus between the capitalist world and the communist world that went right back to the Bolshevik Revolution when the Rothschilds were and Kuhn Loebank were funding Lenin and Trotsky. In any event, so that slid by, you know, me mentally at the time. But something else that McGowan brought out, which I thought was really interesting, David Rockefeller Sr., one of his brothers was William Rockefeller. And William Rockefeller was married to the first cousin of Vito Pelikas. Now, Vito Pelikas was considered one of the founding fathers of the hippie movement, if not the founding father. He was the guy who brought the topless dancers to the Sunset Strip. And according to Wikipedia, he coined the phrase freak out. I mean, he was like the original hippie. Yet his uncle was the father of Winthrop Rockefeller's wife. So you start to put this together from all these observations, and you start to realize that far from being against the hippie movement, the Rockefellers were embracing it, they were funding it, and it certainly brings to mind George Soros, who's a billionaire capitalist, but he's left-wing.
Yeah, it's like the left-wing billionaires, yeah, the guy talked about. George mm-hmm. Soros is a left-wing billionaire, and maybe a right-wing billionaire would be kind of like, the Koch brothers.
Yes. Like
yeah.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Peter Thiel or something, yeah.
Uh-huh. And yeah. I think that paradigm is false. You know, they're really controlling both sides of the narrative. You had the hippies who were fighting the war, as it were, and somehow I was in that movement, and it was absolutely inseparable from free sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, they were all mixed together, and I don't know any hippies or that I can recall who weren't also into drug, sex, and rock and roll culture. I mean, we were anti-war, but my roommate in Cambridge sold hashish, and we went to rock concerts, and people were smoking dope, and it was all part of it, you know. It was embedded in it. But on the other side, contrary to what they thought, the people who started the Vietnam War were not right-wingers. Now, I have another article. It's actually the first article I wrote for my blog on the whole history of the Vietnam War, going back to the Tehran Conference when Franklin D. Roosevelt agreed with Joseph Stalin that the French must be kicked out of Indochina. And of course, we sent the OSS into Indochina, and we actually armed and trained Ho Chi Minh's troops not to fight the communists because it's 1945. I'm sorry, not to fight the Japanese because 1945, that summer, the Japanese were already beaten. We were training to fight the French.
Mm-hmm.
And so the French left. And then we kicked out Bao Dai, the emperor of Vietnam. And this is part of the old divide and conquer strategy. You know, I've talked about this, I don't know, on your show before, but the Rothschild deep state has always been against monarchies, unless they're highly compromised monarchies like the British one of today. But monarchies are a unifying force. People typically, historically, unite around their monarch. So the United States got rid of Bao Dai, and they introduced democracy in the form of Ngo Dinh Diem, who was handpicked by the Council on Foreign Relations, whose gathering he actually spoke before, and he actually was invited to the Rockefeller Estate to have a luncheon there when he came over here in 1957. But that the idea of democracy is it divides a nation, and you know their paradigm is to divide and conquer. So we divided up the Vietnamese people, and when Kennedy first sent troops to Vietnam in October of 61, it was on the advice of Walt Rostow, who was no anti-communist. He'd written a book in 1960, the year before that, calling for an end to American sovereignty. Of course, he was CFR, and his father had been a Marxist revolutionary in Russia. Two of his aunts were members of the Communist Party, and his brother, Eugene Debs Rostow, was named for Eugene Debs, the Socialist Party leader. So you're not talking about anti-communist here. If you look at the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, that was written by William P. Bundy, who had been head of the Alger Hiss Defense Fund back in the 50s. Of course, Alger Hiss, a notorious Soviet spy. And the decision to escalate in Vietnam by Lyndon Baines Johnson was made at the insistence of a group of secret advisors that LBJ had called the Wise Men. And the leader of the Wise Men, the man who was most insistent on escalating the war, was Dean Acheson, if you know about him, besides being with a Scroll and Key, which is the counterpart of Skull and Bones at Yale. He was the father-in-law of William P. Bundy. And if you look at his background, going back to the Chinese takeover of the communist takeover of China, he'd been pro-communist all his life. And his law partner was Donald Hiss, brother of the Soviet spy. I mean, no. So all the guys who got us into Vietnam, this is why the war was stretched out. As Orwell said, he's been paraphrased as saying the war is not meant to be won. It's meant to be continuous. And that war was carried out, I believe, specifically for the express purpose of creating this national divide, because the war was winnable. In fact, I'll shut up after this, but Lloyd Mallon wrote an article for Science and Mechanics back in 1968. He interviewed a dozen retired military officers. Every one of them interviewed separately agreed that the Vietnam War could be won in months. All they had to do was declare war, take the war aggressively to the north, take off the handcuffs of the rules of engagement, which consumed over 20 pages of the congressional record when they're finally declassified. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who went on to become the head of the World Bank, Mr. Establishment, only allowed the Air Force to strike 6% of the targets it wanted to strike. So this war was winnable. It was made unwinnable. And they were playing both sides. They were playing the hawks on one side, but carrying out the war, overruling the military, carrying out the war interminably, while at the same time, their left-wing half was funding this hippie movement.
Yes, that's a wonderful, a synopsis or explanation of these connections of these so-called cold warrior right wingers and their left wing or connections or pedigree, if you will. The Hiss thing is rather interesting because it gets into the politics of the Second World War, what was going on behind the scenes between sort of the left wing and the right wing within the Roosevelt administration and also the Truman administration. You could say that Hiss represented sort of the left wing, and perhaps the Dulles brothers represented the right wing or pro-fascist. But either way, they're all part of the same club, and they're kind of fighting it out because you had, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, the pro-Nazi Dulles faction versus the Zionist left-wing faction under Morgenthau. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was the Dulles faction kind of won out because, you know, Morgenthau had the Morgenthau plan, and then a decision was taken because of the Cold War that West Germany needed to be built up, not deindustrialized, as a bulwark against, I guess, supposedly against, you know, the Red Army in Europe. But this sort of struggle behind the scenes between this left-wing and right-wing faction within the American power structure during the Second World War might explain why Hiss was outed and kind of thrown under the bus. Because, you know, yeah, he was a Soviet spy, but at the end of the day, the Soviets were assets of the Atlanticist powers, the banksters, the international bankers, the Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Second World War was waged to create a situation, to create the bipolar world of the Cold War, and as part of a stepping stone toward the New World Order. And I guess perhaps Stalin didn't cooperate somewhat. So Stalin is, some people interpret Stalin as sort of an unwitting hero against the New World Order, because he didn't really cooperate, and so we got the Cold War. Dean Acheson, didn't he also represent the Soviet interests before they were diplomatically recognized by the Roosevelt administration in 1933?
Going back to when he was a young attorney, he was actually selected by Joseph Stalin to represent Soviet interests in America. So again, this man being the one who personally persuaded Lyndon Baines Johnson to escalate in Vietnam, it just doesn't have credibility that he was that motivated to fight communism without some ulterior motive. And you could look at NATO. Was sold as a bulwark against communism, but there's another aspect to that, which was it was creating this unity between America and Europe, and this is what they were after. In fact, there was an article in the Council on Foreign Relations flagship journal, Foreign Affairs, called Atlantica, and it envisioned this state, the same state really that pretty much that Orwell envisioned as Oceania, where there'd actually be a political bond, that'd actually be a politically united America and Europe. And this would be, they called this the Atlantic Union. And there was a big effort to create Atlantic Union. It was turned down by Congress, but they actually wanted to unify us, much as they've tried to turn NAFTA into a North American Union. This was actual plan in the 1950s. So when they talked about fighting communism, it wasn't that they were really against the communist entity, but they'd done so much to build up. And of course, you're familiar with books like The Best Enemy That Money Can Buy, and Joseph Finder's Red Carpet. There's been a lot of documentation about all the assistance we gave to the communists, and not just during the Lend-Lease Civil War II, but before and after the war. There were so many figures. David Rockefeller had his plane, had private landing rights in Moscow during the height of the Cold War. I mean, there was all this trade going on all the time while we were talking Cold War.
There's even some suggestion that David Rockefeller is the one that sacked Khrushchev.
Yes, because Khrushchev was sacked shortly after his visit in 1964, yeah. And it was hard not to make a connection, given the almighty role that Rockefeller has played in international politics.
George Soros is almost like late 20th, 21st century version of Armin Hammer. Remember him?
Yes, Occidental Petroleum, and he. By the way, his jet also had private landing rights in Moscow during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. And you know, people used to think, why is this guy? He's a billionaire. Why is he? Why is he sympathetic towards communism? And if you were fooled by the left-right paradigm, this created sort of cognitive dissonance. But if you understand why the billionaires like socialism, because they're collectivists, they see themselves as being among the nomenclatura in such a system. But again, if you understand, you know, the works of, like you, as you mentioned, Anthony Sutton's work and these things, that at that level, as Anthony Sutton said, there's no difference between, you know, someone in the Supreme Soviet, high-ranking guy, and maybe a billionaire here in the West, other than the fact that ultimately, I think those in the Soviet Union were actually were employed by by the bankers in the West because they needed the funding because communism just didn't work and it was designed not to work because it would keep Russia poor and weak. And perhaps, you know, Russia got a little stronger than they anticipated. I don't know. These things, these plans don't aren't executed flawlessly, and these things do occur. It makes them have to, you know, make changes and improvise because in reality, human relations, it's complex and central planning doesn't work. But nevertheless, they're the ones behind the curtain or pulling the strings. And the connections you pointed out really make the Cold War makes no sense if you accept the Henry Luce time life version of the Cold War, the mainstream media account, how it's retailed to us. But you could look at the Cold War as sort of a strategy of tension writ large, and that was just an international application of that strategy. Whereas here in the '60s in the United States, it was a domestic application in the '60s. But this type of tension that we saw in the '60s and the kind of tension and trouble we saw throughout the entire 20th century was foreseen, you know, by the Carnegie Foundation, which was exposed by Catherine Casey and working for Norman Dodd. When she was reading the minutes of this foundation, they talked about they predicted or foresaw the best way to fundamentally change, collectivize the United States is to subject it to a series of wars and conflicts. And you could say that you could look at the Great Depression perhaps as a sort of a shock doctrine type approach to that, and also the wars itself as a way to fundamentally change the country, scar the country, and certainly it did. America was a much different country in 1946 than it was in 1917, and, you know, mission accomplished.
Many times, and certainly with the Vietnam War, even more so. But yeah, there's always been this relationship between the bankers, and, you know, it's very easy to document the role of the bankers and bankrolling the beginning of communism in 1917 when Kuhn Loeb funded Trotsky with $20 million in gold. And they also set up an account in Sweden for Lenin and Trotsky with $50 million in it. And, of course, one of the partners in Kuhn Loeb in America was Paul Warburg. Well, his brother Max Warburg in Germany arranged that trip of Lenin into Russia, you know, coming up all these 100th anniversaries this year, the Bolshevik Revolution meeting in 1917. But he arranged for Lenin to go in with millions in gold on that famous train. And so the bankers were always involved, and they got payback, by the way, of an article called Do Americans Face a Red Terror? It was written about 3 years ago, but it talks about how the banks and the Freemasonic lodges got payback in Russian wealth from the early Bolsheviks. And it's not me who uncovered that. It was actually Jiri Lina in his book Under the Sign of the Scorpion. He went into the KGB files after Glasnost had opened them up and found that even the order to execute the Tsar had come from New York City, not from Lenin himself. But then you take it ahead. This is a quote that I find very relevant to why communism and capitalism work together. This is from a Fabian socialist named Nicholas Murray Butler speaking in 1937. He said, quote, "Communism is the instrument with which the financial world will topple national governments and then erect a world government with a world police and a world money," unquote. And, unquote. And so I've always seen these revolutions, and this is why I often speak favorably about monarchies, is the Rothschilds always viewed monarchies, be it the Emperor of China or the Tsar in Russia or any of the kings of Europe. They wanted to topple these monarchs because they could not get into the bloodline of a monarch. So they wanted the monarchs to go so that they could install quote-unquote democracy. This is what I was just talking about in Vietnam with Bao Dai and being replaced by Nguyen Dinh Diem and an electoral system. Get rid of the monarchs, and then they knew they couldn't control the monarchs necessarily, but they could control the democratic process because in a democracy, people will vote for who the newspapers tell them to vote for. And, of course, the Rothschilds with the wealth could always control the newspapers and control public opinion. Their candidates would always be selected. So communism is a tool that they've used to get rid of governments they didn't like it's not really an end of itself. But, you know, as a matter of fact, here's an interesting quote. So many of these bankers were Zionists. I can't read the quote here, but it's a, I printed it out, and it's from a graphic.
Graphic.
But it was a quote from Stephen Wise, who is a leading Zionist in America in the 20th century. He said that basically said that Judaism is the same thing as communism. And when you look at the fact that anti-Semitism was made a capital offense by Lenin, and it was the death penalty to own the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and you look at the 85%. Of the Soviet leadership as Jewish in those early days, you realize that there's a very powerful correlation between the two, between the bankers, most of whom are Zionists, and their Freemasonic underlings in the communist world. And that also showed up again, once again, raised its head during the 60s.
That was Rabbi Stephen Wise?
Yes.
He was head of the American Jewish Council, right? Or committee in the 30s and 40s?
Yeah, he was one of the major forces of Zionism and the pro-war, pro-World War II and the creation of the State of Israel.
And a harsh critic of Charles Lindbergh, if I recall.
Yeah, Lindy was in a unique position because he was an undeniable – he was actually considered the greatest hero of his time after that solo 1927 flight to Paris. And he became feared because he was so popular – that he actually could have run for president and won. The problem was that he was only in his 20s when he made that flight, and it was going to take him maybe 8 years to become 35 and be qualified to run for president. But he was definitely feared, and the wrath of the establishment really turned on him when he joined the America First Committee and started to follow in his father's footsteps, his father, of course, being a man who wrote a book called Why You're Country is at War, which is suppressed by the U.S. government, and also a great critic of the Federal Reserve. In fact, when he was in Congress, he actually introduced a resolution to impeach the entire Federal Reserve Board. And when Lindy started to follow in his father's footsteps, at least in the anti-war sense, the wrath of the American establishment turned on him.
Yes, I think it was Charles Lindbergh Sr. who said that with the creation of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, which was a central bank, but it was the way it was designed was, 12 regions, and ultimately it was the New York Fed that was dominant, so it was sort of like a secret or a central bank undercover, as opposed to a Federal Reserve controlled regionally and all that stuff. But he said that with the creation of the Federal Reserve, that booms and busts will be scientifically created.
Yes, that's exactly what he said. He was quite right, and he predicted that there would be a crash. And, of course, that came in 1929. He said they'll just create inflation at will, and then they'll unload the stocks on people. In fact, I can't even get the exact quote. What do you fill in with a remark here? But it's worth referring to that. The two amazing men, the Lindberghs, that they were both so accomplished, one as an opponent of the Fed, and that his son then made that very heroic trip. Initially, Charles Jr. was not interested in politics. He was just interested, I think he was just 25 when he made that trip. He was really totally into flying, but as he matured, he started to take his father's politics seriously. But here's what Charles Lindbergh Sr. said on the floor of the House about the Federal Reserve Act. He said, quote, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this act, the invisible government by the money power," he's talking about Warburg and Rockefeller and Morgan, "proven to exist by the money trust legislation will be legalized. The money power overawes the legislature and the executive forces of the nation." Just an aside here, Tim, still true today. Okay, but continue with the quote. Lindbergh says, quote, "I've seen these forces exerted during the different stages of this bill. From now on, depressions will be scientifically created. The new bill will create inflation whenever the trust wants inflation. The trust can get a period of inflation. They figure they can unload stocks on the people at high prices during the excitement, then bring on a panic and buy them back at low prices. The people may not know it immediately, but the day of reckoning is only a few years removed," unquote. And that did come to pass, Tim, in 1929, when Warburg and Rockefeller and Morgan all had pulled out of the stock market, but millions of small investors were wiped out. And, you know, they did that through a variety of tricks, such as short selling the market, having the Fed, which they controlled, raise interest rates, and also calling in loans on people who'd borrowed on margin to buy stocks. So they combined all that, and then they created a genuine panic among the small investors, and everybody was trying to get out. But they know how to play the carrot and stick in the stock market to get whatever they want. And Congressman Lindbergh was quite prophetic in that regard.
Then during the panic, well, first thing, the Federal Reserve is ostensibly created because of the 1907 panic, when the Knickerbocker Trust Company folded, which apparently, at least it's a lot of evidence suggests that panic was created by a whisper campaign by J.P. Morgan himself.
Correct.
Because all these banking houses are intentionally made to be unstable because they loan on margin. It's all fractional reserve, and they want to maximize profit by loaning out at interest. But at any given time, another banking house can call in a loan and cause a panic. And if you know that's going to happen, you can come in and buy everything out of a song and cause a panic. And apparently, that's what occurred during the Great Depression because we were told that the whole purpose of the Federal Reserve was to create an elastic money supply to arrest the panic. But they didn't do that in 1920, 1930. They actually raised interest rates and caused a third of the banks to close in the country when they could have been solved just by simply creating liquidity for these banks. They did the very thing the very thing it was supposed to do, it didn't do. And it caused this deep recession. And then, of course, subsequently, everyone gets the wrong. Of course, people like Bernanke uses that as an excuse, several decades later for quantitative easing, as if the solution is just print more money. that's the lesson, okay. But the problem is it doesn't go to it doesn't address the central problem, which is probably central banking and also, you could also say compound interest, which is unstable too. Usury,
Yes, they are the problem. They are the problem. They're the cause. They say they're trying to control inflation, but they're actually creating it by making money out of nothing. Otherwise, we'd have a stable dollar, which we did have, by the way. Prices were relatively stable from the days of the Pilgrims up until the creation of the Federal Reserve. And I've got a graph from Oregon State University in my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, that shows the prices. And there are little blips up and down, but it wasn't until the creation of the Fed that you see this skyrocket of prices, which has led to a 98% loss of value in the dollar since the Fed was established in 1913.
Mm-hmm. And, someone has profited from that. There's always, when you're engaged in counterfeiting, there's always a small group that benefits from it. And, of course, it's the banksters and the people connected to the state, particularly the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Wall Street, of course, the money class, the paper billionaires, they're the one that profit from it because they can use this electronic money to acquire real assets, to concentrate the economy, to corporatize everything, which is what we're seeing. This huge concentration we're seeing is a product of that because they're getting the cheap capital, and they can.
Right. They get money created out of nothing, which they then, this money created from nothing, they loan and get the poor middle class guy to pay them back interest on it through a credit card or a mortgage.
Yeah, there's a it's not just a coincidence that when Nixon closed the gold window in '71 and caused allowed for the inflation of the '70s, which was a headache from the '60s, the guns and butter policy, and there's a whole lot of political intrigue involved in that those decisions that were taken with the Nixon administration. A lot to do with electoral politics, but I think ultimately the bankers were controlling him. And when he got out of control, he got Watergate. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But the closing of the gold window also ushered in the era of the credit card. So inflation, and also the stagnation of wages in the United States. Mm-hmm. In 1973, it followed along with the closing the gold window, and there's a reason for that. But then you get with debasement, you get easy credit. But instead of having your wages actually increase in value with a stable dollar and increased productivity, and financing your consumption and higher living standard with equity or savings, you're now doing it with a credit card. Now, what's the difference? You're in debt forever.
That's right? What they want.
Yep.
That's the game. Yep.
And they do it with nations, entire nations. That's what Henry Kissinger's infamous memorandum in 1974, NSS 200, talked about loading the country down, loading the developing world with debt that was enabled by the oil shocks, which were orchestrated by Kissinger, according to Bill Engdahl, you know, the Yom Kippur War, but load them down with debt, not only to arrest the development in the third world, but to, again, so then they could acquire the assets on the cheap, because the collateral for all this third world debt, which was then triggered in the late 70s by all this stuff, would inevitably result in the oligarchs getting control of the resources and being able to exploit the labor, which we're now seeing in places like China, you know, in India, you know, which also facilitated the deindustrialization of the United States, because the petrodollar and created the artificially strong dollar, but also created made imports cheap, which causes deindustrialization here in the United States. You know, we're seeing now what's large, but the whole point is, again, it's all about, but it was Kissinger who also, in that memorandum, also called for the doubling of the death rate in the third world. Because
and isn't it interesting how all these financial and geopolitical oligarchs of the deep state are all in favor of population control? Mm-hmm. And it seems that they want a small population, so when their Luciferian New World Order actually comes into being, you know, it's easier to control a small population than a big one.
Yeah, and that's just why you see what's going on in Africa. I mean, just to get back to our conversation that was going back here in the United States with the protests and the disruptions and the strategy of tension. But in Africa, the neocolonialism, you know, you had this era of decolonization after the Second World War, but the Western powers realized it was cheaper just to install puppets or satraps to terrorize their own people and do the dirty work for them and cause civil wars. And then you could go in and grab up the resources, you know, whether it's the precious metals in the Great Lakes regions or the oil in Africa. The same thing applies to the Middle East and Latin America and even Asia. That's largely what motivated the Vietnam War, was that they wanted to fundamentally change the Vietnamese culture, turn it into workers and consumers, you know, some sort of weird trilateralist plan, I suppose. But, yeah, I mean, and that's the same thing that's happening here. Now, look what's happening with student debt, people with, heavy mortgages, houses underwater. They're desperate, and, you know, they're not making enough to save anything anymore. And those people are easily manageable. But it's also a boiling pot, because it can explode, you know. Perhaps that explains the, why Trump was elected. Maybe they didn't quite foresee that. So...
Well, people have woken up in a way that they weren't anticipating. I think they anticipated that the internet was something people would just use to shop on and exchange Facebook photos, and they didn't realize that people were going to have this great awakening that we've seen, to the point that whether Trump is real or not, he's the first candidate to actually come out and talk about the mainstream media. I've never heard a major political candidate use the phrase mainstream media before. Clinton or Gore, Bob Dole, no previous candidate even acknowledged there was such a thing as mainstream media. But now we have that recognized, and I think that they are actually on the run, in that we've had this great awakening. And that's what Zbigniew Brzezinski was talking about when he said today it's easier to kill a million people than to control a million people. He was referring to the fact that so many people are awake that it's very difficult to control them now.
Yeah, or this is what Samuel P. Huntington called the crisis of democracy in the 70s, that people were too active, too aware, and they needed to the measures needed to be taken to control them. And I think the internet was probably introduced as a monitoring device, and it still is. It's a wonderful tracking and monitoring device. Same with all the little gadgets and technologies that we use now. Everyone's addicted to this technology, and under the guise of convenience and efficiency. But may I suggest that it's a lot more convenient to never lock your door, because you don't have to bother using the keys. But it's also very dangerous. There's a reason why we lock our windows and lock our doors. And the same thing we should think about, we should apply that same thought when we think about internet banking. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, whether we should have GPS in our car all the time, or we should walk mm-hmm. around with a monitoring device called our cell phone all the time. Yeah, it's very convenient to have a phone all the time, but also you can't get away from anything anymore. Not to mention the fact that these things probably have a deleterious effect on your health because, you know, it's mm-hmm. because of the magnetic or electronic pollution they create, you know. But, yeah, I mean, so, it's, like I said, the plan for global government, these things, these plans aren't executed flawlessly, and they have to deal with the complexities of human affairs. But nevertheless, I think they're still marching on with their ultimate plan. It's just taking some detours. But back to the article, you talk about some of the things in the, now, a lot of what we're talking about, the destabilization efforts, and some people may consider it conspiracy theory and all that. There's a history to this stuff because in the 1960s, you had COINTELPRO, which is now documented and admitted. You had Operation Chaos, which is a CIA operation here in the United States to sow chaos, to undermine groups and infiltrate groups and cause problems. This had a considerable effect on the country's domestic politics, because we had, well, you talk about Dave McGowan, of course, the music scene, and how that kind of shocked maybe the World War II generation, contributed to the generational gap that was so prominent back in the 1960s. The war itself was a huge shock. Wars always are. War is a psychological warfare operation. I think it was Chris Milligan who talked about the Vietnam War, his father telling him that the purpose of the war itself was to create a division between generations. And at the same time, it was also facilitating the importation of heroin into the United States, and also creating a huge market because so many soldiers became addicted to heroin and came back home. And also the drugs itself were shipped back in the bodies of dead U.S. soldiers. So it also became a method of importing the drug itself. But according to Chris Milligan, this was all part of a plan to opiate the masses and divide the generations.
Yes, I think like most wars, the Vietnam War was multidimensional. I think that part of it was, as you say, to control the Indochinese drug trade, much as we're controlling the Afghanistan drug trade today. That's seems to be a major impetus for our military interventions. But I think they were also trying to create a national divide in order to get rid of the draft. All the draft cards being burned. My feeling is that people in the deep state, Zionists in the deep state, did not want their offspring to be fighting their wars any longer. And they wanted to move into an all-volunteer army, which could be utilized ultimately as an international police force. Now, it's pretty difficult to have an international police force if you've got a draft, because everybody goes into the draft who's physically able to join. And if you've got draftees, you can get people with scruples about doing immoral things. But if you have a non-draftee army, it's much easier to convert it to the type of purposes which our army is being used and our military is being used for these days.
You could also create a military subculture, right? Entirely a military class, easier, right?
Certainly.
I'm not an advocate of the draft of conscription, but I'm saying the difference is that if it's all volunteer, and also you can make it call it all volunteer, but if you deindustrialize the country, create the Rust Belt, these people no longer have any alternative other than to join the army to find employment. So it may appear to be volunteer, but their options have been so narrowed by macroeconomic policies taken by, these people at Bilderberg or Davos, that they have no other choice. The factory shut down. They have no other means of gainful employment. And so they join the military. That also coincides with a huge psyop with, you know, with recruitment ads and the whole Hollywood stuff, glorifying the military and all that stuff. But my point is that you can create, you know, same way that they, you know, you create a subculture of police who often now refer to non-police as civilians, which used to not be the case. Police were usually thought as being civilian themselves too. Now that you hear that frequently, say police referring to people, you know, average person as a civilian, as if he's not a civilian. Well, no, police are supposed to be civilians too. It wasn't supposed to be that way. That's all part of the militarization of the police, which is all probably all part of the agenda. But yeah, I'm just saying you can create a separate military class as opposed to like, you know, like a mass army that's drafted because they're just going in and out and they're not, they don't have careers in the military. But I'm sorry, right. Go ahead.
You're right. These individuals quite often don't have any choice except to join the army, but those offspring of the super rich do have a choice. They definitely do not have to go in. Mm-hmm. And that's why you'll see so few of the rich entering. But there was a time when they were not exempt. They could probably get some wires pulled and get a cushy job like during the Korean War. Ted Kennedy had guard duty, I think it was at NATO headquarters in Europe. But the end of the draft meant the end of their own children, the elite having to go into the army. This certainly was one of their motives. They also, I'm convinced that the Vietnam War was by design intended to change American culture, to create a war on our values. What I said in the article was we went from a Leave It to Beaver culture to a Woodstock culture because, you know, in 63, we were still watching Leave It to Beaver. And in 69, we had Woodstock. It was a rapid, rapid change. And I do believe that this was part of a war on our values, a war on Christian values, you know, free sex, which used to be called immorality, is now part of that whole hippie culture, which, you know, I was into.
It used to be called fornication, not free love, you know. And there was, you know, some clear understanding of these things. And it was a broad acceptance of these values. And you're right. There was a almost a reverse alchemical process in those mere 6 years. And the trauma of the Kennedy assassination, the introduction of loud rock music with the Beatles, Rolling Stones, subsequently Led Zeppelin, and that's why Dave McGowan's work is so important, all this stuff. And you, I mean, what's important to you is you're talking about this because you experienced it. This is the music I listen to because it's probably the best pop music that was ever created, rock music. So it resonates, but that's its power, I guess. It's music since then has been continually dumbed down, in my opinion, for another reason. But you're right. I mean, you're talking about a rapid decline in public morality. And war always creates that, you know, war always creates that. High divorce rates, there's, you know, people cheating on each other because you're separated. To this day, the divorce rate in the military is exceedingly high. The military runs the largest daycare centers in the world. So the family, I mean, these children are being institutionalized and all that stuff. So, you know, and the irony is that in this country, conservatives, you know, support the military. When arguably the military, at least how it's currently constituted in this country today, is probably the most disruptive to the values they claim to support, family values.
Exactly. Hey, listen, Tim, you know, I feel like thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay, we're back. So we're talking about the culture, how it changed in the 1960s. And, of course, this wasn't a spontaneous or an organic reaction to independent or separate events. It was being directed to a large extent, correct?
Yeah, and one of the ways it was being directed was in the music industry, and this comes to a lot of people as a surprise, because today people who are anti-war, and I remain anti-war, tend to think of the counterculture as the heroic rebels and the quote-unquote hawks as representing the establishment, when really I think it was the opposite. But I'm going to have to elaborate on that. Now, did you have David McGowan on as a guest before he passed away?
He was my first guest on my podcast, yeah.
Fantastic. You're going to have to go back and listen to that. But, you know, I've read his book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, and it was such an eye-opener to discover the links between the hippie music scene and the establishment, in that he focuses in on one particular region of the music industry, which was the Laurel Canyon neighborhood of Los Angeles, and where some of the most famous bands came from. And he points out a lot of things which really changed my view of that. I still think that was great music, but it seems that a lot of that music wasn't created by the people we thought it was, and that they had quite a bit of help in getting onto the airwaves. And one example he gives is Jim Morrison and the Doors. Now, a lot of people still don't know that Jim Morrison was the son of Admiral George Morrison, who was commanding the forces, the naval forces, in the Tonkin Gulf at the time of the famed Tonkin Gulf incident. And the Doors had a remarkable success story. Jim Morrison had never had any singing or music experience before, and none of the people in his band had ever been in a band before. The band members never changed. And unlike most bands who have to go through years of, you know, changing band members and having a lot of flops before you get a hit, and playing, you know, in lounges and coffee houses, these guys just had instant success. They almost instantly, I shouldn't say instant, very quickly had an array of hits, a recording contract. And what McGowan points out is how many of these bands were connected to intelligence and to the military. In their case, their manager, Paul Rothschild, had been in military intelligence, and suddenly they had this recording contract and were able to have their hits showcased across the country. And of course, his career ended just as quickly as it had begun when he died in 1971. But then you look at the rest of the Laurel Canyon crowd, and I even have a embedded this song in the blog post, but the hippie song that best characterized that generation was San Francisco, which was written by Papa John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas for his friend Scott McKenzie. And what most people don't know is that Papa John Phillips, his father was a Marine captain, and he attended military prep schools, went to Annapolis, although he dropped out. His first wife worked for the Pentagon, and his sister worked for the Pentagon for 30 years, military background. Or if you go to Buffalo Springfield, which did a song called For What It's Worth, which really wasn't about a war protest, but nevertheless kind of symbolized the protest movement. They also had meteoric success. They supposedly met on the Sunset Strip in April of 66, yet just 3 months after they formed the band, they already released their first single and were opening for the Rolling Stones at Hollywood Bowl. And it turns out that Stephen Stills attended elite military schools, and David Crosby, who became Crosby, part of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, was the son of a military intelligence officer. And it's the same thing for Frank Zappa. You know, when I became a hippie and I was listening to music, they said, if you really want to go heavy duty, listen to Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And it turns out, let me just make sure that I get it right here. He was, his father was a chemical warfare specialist. He grew up in military facilities at the Edgewood Arsenal. And his wife, Gail, was a daughter of a Navy nuclear weapons specialist. And she herself worked as a secretary in the Office of Naval Research and Development. And actually, Tim, if you go to the, you know, to his book, he talks about Jackson Browne came from a career military family. The band America were all Air Force brats. Dennis Hopper's family was military. John Denver's father was a career military officer. It just goes on and on. And you could say
that reminds me of when you mentioned Dennis Hopper. I was reading Dave McCarron's. Laurel Canyon thing was a part of a. His web blog. It wasn't a book yet. and so I'm reading it, and he goes, Dennis Hopper, I think he married, what's her name, from the Mamas and the Papas for 2 days or something?
Okay, probably.
What was her name again?
Michelle Phillips, was it?
Michelle Phillips, yeah. Michelle Phillips claimed that the 2 days she was tortured and all types of weird things done to her. And Dennis Hopper said, no, that wasn't true. I just hit her a little bit. And Dave McGowan goes, well, in Dennis Hopper's effed up world, this makes him less of an asshole. It's like, well, I'd only hit her. That's his thing. Only hit her. Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's okay.
Could have been worse. And with Pizzagate, we know it's been a lot worse.
Yeah.
But
go on. I'm sorry. I interrupted. You know how Dave McGowan wrote? He'd have this dry humor about, you know, right. And you start cracking up, you know, reading that stuff. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, he's a terrific writer. But it was really across the boards, the characterization of the military in Hollywood was another one, which is very distinct and unique. You had, during the 1960s, you had a lot of counterculture movies. Easy Rider was a famous one. And on Broadway, they had Hair. And it constantly spurred on the anti-war counterculture. Yet during the course of the Vietnam War, which lasted for 14 years, there was only one major film that was sympathetic to the war, and that was The Green Berets. And from what I've read of John Wayne's bio, the only reason that movie got made, and as you know, it was furiously protested. People were picketing the movie. And I don't think it was that good of a movie, but it was made with the best of intentions. The only reason it got made was because John Wayne was persistent and he still had so much clout in Hollywood, he was able to get cooperation with it. But if you look at the movies, how they betrayed the military, you had the Bedford incident, where you've got this paranoiac destroyer commander played by Richard Widmark, who ruthlessly pursues a Soviet sub and ends up with the destruction of his own vessel. And you've got 7 days in May, which is made in 64. Bedford incident was 65. 64, of course, is the year of Tonkin Gulf. And you've got 7 days in May, where the military is autocratic and they want to seize control of the government to fight communism. They're the bad guys. The military is the bad guys. And the classic example is Dr. Strangelove. And every American military figure in there is portrayed negatively, whether it's George C. Scott as the Pentagon guy, or General Jack Ripper, who launches this unilateral strike on the Soviet Union in order to destroy communism and protect our precious bodily fluids, played by Sterling Hayden. Very negative image. Now, I've got an embedded clip there where he says that war must not be left to politicians, it must be left to the generals. And, of course, he's playing a madman as a general. And I believe that was very deliberate, because we were just launching the escalation of the Vietnam War, and that war was run by politicians, not by generals. The generals were constantly overruled. And so the entire makeup of the Hollywood depiction of our current military was that of paranoiacs and authoritarians. But if you look at their portrayal of the World War II military, even during the war in Vietnam, no protest of that. It was always portrayed as valorous and virtuous. It was definitely a setup. And then you carry it over to television. You had All in the Family. And I've got a clip there of Archie Bunker talking about gun control, and he mispronounces every other word. And his son-in-law is raising his eyebrows and, you know, shaking his head, and the audience is laughing at Archie. And you're definitely being cued by the reactions of the canned laughter and the son-in-law, how you are to react to stupid Archie Bunker, who is supposed to be the prototypal conservative. This is why I'm saying mainstream media was not pro-war. Mainstream media was against the war, which they were dragging out, as we mentioned earlier, interminably. And then if you look at the news coverage, was constantly negative. And I remember getting enraged watching the Huntley Brinkley report as they interviewed Vice President Ki of South Vietnam. I didn't realize how much I was being played. But people don't know this today, but the news media was consistently negative and misrepresented what was going on in Vietnam. For example, they never ceased to tell us about the My Lai massacre, but they never talked about the communist massacres like the massacre in Hue. And they portrayed the Battle of Khe Sanh as a horrendous defeat, when in fact, although the Marines lost 199 dead, the communists lost about 10,000 dead, and they never took the base. They portrayed it as a defeat. And you know, there was an excellent documentary. It's not perfect. It didn't recognize the existence of the deep state, but it's called Television's Vietnam. And you know what? That has been blacked out. I found it was not on YouTube, no DVDs, but I had an old video cassette, and I've got this friend at a YouTube channel called Federal Expression. I sent him a copy, and he was able to upload a really nice version of it. So we've now got that, resurrected that onto YouTube. But the distortion of what went on in Vietnam by the media was also, much like the media today is driving the Soros protesters, it was feeding the anti-war frenzy. So it's a much different picture. I don't regard the protesters and my hippie friends of that day who were much more into drugs than they were. There's no talk about truth. We weren't a truth movement. It was about drugs, sex, rock and roll, and by the way, we don't want to get drafted. And there was a good reason not to be drafted, because again, they were stretching out a winnable war into an interminable one, but it was not the heroic episode that many people in alt media today believe it was.
Yeah. I think the important point you're making here, you're not endorsing the war. You're citing that the war itself was designed to be strung out to cause maximum damage here at home and abroad,
mm-hmm.
To run up the bills, so to speak. Obviously, that was a big part of it right there. All the the weaponry and armaments and hardware that was being expended over particularly the helicopters. This was big money. The dredging of harbors,
yes.
And these things. Mm-hmm. But the whole point is that. The reason why the coverage is so negative, it's there, isn't there to inform the public, so the public can then go ahead and make a decision at the voting booths, put pressure on the representatives. It's there to just to antagonize, divide, because obviously World War II generation guys who are then in their 40s and 50s watching the news are going to get mad at the media undermining the troops, and the young guys are going to say, look, what's going on here? The army's over there engaged in mass slaughter. They're killing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of that is to create that divide.
And the outcome was predictable. And you knew which side was going to win this national division because whether it was Broadway or the news media or Hollywood, you had always the doves were portrayed as the good guys and the hawks as the Archie Bunkers and the bad guys. And of course, the war was stretched out until 1975. And then the doves said, we told you so. And then the whole culture had been changed. And I call this a variation on Stockholm syndrome. Since we've been defeated by communists, a lot of my generation became the power that they lost to. They became left wing. We became cultural Marxist over here in America. And then piggybacked onto the anti-war movement were all these other things, the feminist movement. And, I talk in the article, I've got a clip of Timothy Leary, the guru of LSD, saying that the CIA created the entire counterculture. We also know that Gloria Steinem, and I've got a clip of her there, linked to at least, where she talks about her years with the CIA. But they added on the feminist movement, and the gay movement, and pro-abortion, and all these other things that now we see coming to open Satanism, and pedophilia, and transhumanism, and transgenderism. That all goes back to that original counterculture. The counterculture is what the powers that be wanted. They didn't want victory in Vietnam. They wanted to use it to create a national divide, and that national divide is something that I see happening, reemerging now.
Yeah, and the stage was set for this was in the 50s, because you had the Rockefeller Foundation-backed Alfred Kinsey in his studies in the late mm-hmm. 40s and
yes.
50s, justifying Thick. Pedophilia, homosexuality, promiscuity. In the early 60s, 30 years of research came to fruition when the Rockefellers were able to produce the contraceptive pill. At the
Part
same
of the
time,
population control.
Yeah. Yeah. At the same time, you have Time Life and the infiltration of the Catholic Church at Vatican II. weakening the Catholic Church.
Correct.
Had a profound effect because that's what urban renewal was all about, breaking up the urban neighborhoods, because you simply couldn't have much of the cultural warfare that you had in the 60s would not have been possible if you had these concentrated Catholic neighborhoods, and a strong, Catholic Church, because they're the ones that held back Hollywood in many respects, because they're the ones that imposed the production code, and that's why, one of the reasons why the Church got the ire of the Jewish power block in the United States, because they were holding back Hollywood. But you also have the publication of the Authoritarian Personality by the American Jewish Committee, that came out, more or less said that America threatens to be taken over by fascism, and in order to avoid the rise of another Hitler, we had to weaken the family and also particularly target the strong male role model.
And they successfully did that.
Yeah. Do that through sex. And that's what Herbert Marcuse was all about, Eros and Civilization. Wilhelm Reich, although I think he died in the early 60s, but he was a hero of the 60s, right? I think he was, New York Times talked about him. And I think in the student riots of 1968, they were throwing copies of his book on fascism at the police. So that's how influential he was, But these are cultural Marxists and to a man Jewish. So there's a big ethnic component here to this.
And I want to ask you something too, Timothy, from your perspective as a Catholic, and we've talked about the Catholic neighborhoods being broken up and with the creation of suburbia on previous programs. But I heard something recently, and maybe you can verify what you've heard as to the credibility of this, that there was actually, after Vatican II in 1963, according to Malachi Martin, there was actually an enthronement of Lucifer at the Vatican. Do you attach any credence to that?
The problem with Malachi Martin is he posed himself as a conservative, but he was a closet radical at Vatican II, and he's been tied to B'nai B'rith. He was an agent of B'nai B'rith. That isn't to say I think he wrote a book, Keys to This Blood or something, about the Vatican, and some of his criticisms I think are probably valid. It's sort of like a limited hangout. But he also had an affair with a reporter at Vatican II. And he was an agent of the Jews at Vatican II.
Well, you're certainly
that was a good job of demolishing
Martin.
Yeah, that was exposed in Look magazine in 1960. I just talked to E. Michael Jones about this actually. In Look magazine in 1966, did a thing about the Jewish agent at Vatican II. Then Look magazine then ceased publishing a year later. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not. But then years later, the agent was identified as Malachi Martin.
Well, one reason I wanted to ask you about that was that 63 was, to me, a pivot year. And it was also the year that the Supreme Court banned school prayer. Mm-hmm. And there was a significant decline or change in our culture beginning right after that.
Well, the courts are a big part of it.
I perceive just in the way people acted and behaved from 1963 to 1964. And of course, in 64, we had the Beatles appear on Ed Sullivan. We had Tonkin Gulf. And of course, in November of 63, we had Kennedy's assassination. Mm-hmm. So if something significant spiritually had happened in the summer of 63, such as that, it might shed some light on when we had this sudden cultural shift taking place at that time. But I was just curious from
I wouldn't dismiss what he said, because again, you have to consider the source. But I think it's clear at this point that the church has been infiltrated and weakened in many respects.
Yes,
from Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even some suggesting that some popes were closet Freemasons. And you mentioned earlier, Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn, I just did an article about human compromise. He was big into blackmailing people, particularly sexual blackmail. And of course, he's tied to Donald Trump. He's connected to Donald Trump. But Roy Cohn apparently had the goods in Cardinal Spellman. And Cardinal Spellman was very supportive of the Vietnam War. So this is an example of how the church is neutered, as opposed to the church being a strong separate body that can actually present a competing power block against the state. Unfortunately, it appears that the church has been infiltrated and weakened largely through human compromise. So what he's talking about satanic sex abuse occurring at the Vatican. Unfortunately, I can't say that's not happening, because look at what happened here in the United States, up in your area with Bernard Law. Good example is a lot of that. Again, you have to talk about the culture. A lot of people, movies like Spotlight, they make movies about the Catholic Church and pedophilia, or what they call pedophilia, so the sex scandals and all this stuff. A lot of attention is paid to that by Hollywood and by the media. Very little attention is paid to what goes out in Hollywood, where pedophilia is the norm. It's part of the business out there. In fact, it's, if you see shows like an open documentaries like An Open Secret, the lady, I think her name is like Amy Berg, I think, she did a documentary on the Catholic Church and the sex pedophilia scandals, and everyone loved it. She got awards. Then she did one called An Open Secret about Hollywood, and no one's heard about it. But the point here, what I'm saying is that the sexual revolution, the things that was the very thing that was promoted by the mainstream media, by Hollywood, of Madison Avenue, by the foundations, by the Rockefellers, these things, this feminism, this stuff, all the stuff is being supported by the power structure to fundamentally change society, to make people looser regarding sex, the open celebration of homosexuality with the Stonewall riots. The real truth behind the Stonewall riots was the Stonewall was an epicenter of human trafficking, child sex trafficking, and drugs. Talk to Jim Rothstein about that, what really happened at Stonewall. And he talks about the 50-year plan to fundamentally change the country through sexual perversion. And we're seeing that played out now. You cannot fundamentally change society that way and not expect the church, particularly the scandals within the church, the sex scandals, you can't take that out of the context of the sexual revolution, because all the powers that be, Madison Avenue, Hollywood, mainstream media, educational institutions, have sought to sexualize the culture, even children, under the guise of sex education and age education, have sought to sexualize children. You can't do that to fundamentally change the culture, then expect the church to be immune from it. Because the church draws from the cultural well, so if you pollute the cultural well with sexual liberation, it's going to affect the church.
Well, it's certainly going to affect the church members, and the priesthood would have to be very resilient and strong to resist it and to keep the congregation in a moral basis.
Yeah, but the breakup of what's key about the breakup of the urban neighborhoods is that when you went into suburbia, you lost your Catholic identity. You didn't relate to the parish anymore. You just were part of this diaspora into suburbia. You became the white middle class. You're no longer Italian Catholic or German Catholic. And this all plays in this Freemasonic theme about multiculturalism and the melting pot. And it's all about breaking down the differences and all this stuff. We're supposed to think of these ethnic differences as being, retrograde or backward, or restricting in many ways, because you're restricting our freedom to express, to be ourselves, be the individual.
Sure.
The problem is you're destroying the mediating institutions like family, ethnic identity, religion. These things protect the individual from the corporate state, which wants to enslave everybody. It's not perfect, but given the reality of human nature, we need these things. We need family. We need things like marriage and familial bonds and these things that actually transcend the state to limit the state. And the problem with some of the libertarian, I would say, is through the dialectic by enthroning the individual and all talking about individual rights and these things, which includes gay rights in many times now, you're atomizing the individual and creating a society of just individuals that have no identity, no community to protect themselves, and that's what we're seeing today. A lot of this goes back to the 60s, what you're writing about, and it's hard to identify or acknowledge that that we ourselves have been guinea pigs in a societal experiment.
Yes, it's a continuum through time, and just as you mentioned, the intentional breakup of the traditional Catholic parish same thing was done to the Protestant church, which began, you know, with Lutheranism, with Luther and the Lutheran church. And then that was splintered mm-hmm. into hundreds and hundreds of denominations until it's just pick your own and no stability for people to hang on to, and people getting further and further away from the original Christian faith.
Mm-hmm. And the movies were a big part, and the entertainment, of course, were a big part of this. This is why to this day Hollywood is, you know, Joe Atwell says, don't think of it as a sewer, think of it as a weapon, and you get a better idea of what Hollywood is all about. If Hollywood can be used to sell, you know, product placement, whether it's cigarettes or a beer or a car or a computer, it can be used to be sold to sell ideas or values. And Jay Dyer, who does a lot of work about Hollywood and the CIA and some of the esoteric meaning of Hollywood, and he has a book called Esoteric Hollywood, and mm-hmm. talks a lot about this stuff, that yes, Hollywood, it's used to sell a certain viewpoint or outlook on life. Same way that the Time Life Publishing Empire, Henry Luce, was used to sell the idea of Americana, the American century, how Life magazine told us what it was like to be an American. Time magazine told us what was going on in the world according to Skull and Bones. Fortune magazine told us that it was all about, you know, that's the prosperity gospel, I guess you could say. And then there was Sports Illustrated with the swimsuit edition. The good life was having a girl in a bikini by your side and sports, you know. Sports in general is a huge social engineering, psychological warfare operation now. I was just at the gym recently, I think it was watching one of the ESPN channels I was on, and I had the sound down, but what I identified was there's this case of the 17-year-old teenager or 17-year-old high school student in Texas who identifies as a girl who's wrestling girls, and surprise, surprise, he won the state championship.
Well, there's a meme of a guy on the Titanic, and the guy in the lifeboat says, women and children first, and he says, well, I'm transgender.
Yeah. It's funny. It used to be if someone did that, they were called a coward. Now they guess he'd be called a hero.
But that's part of the satanic craziness that's being implemented. And again, for America, it's been ongoing. You could probably say it's been ongoing for centuries, but the big cultural shift was definitely in the 60s. And well, that's why I say it wasn't like the alt media of today who's trying to steer us back onto the right path. Those people were actually following the dictates of the CIA mm-hmm. and the powers that be. Without knowing it, they were playing both sides of the Vietnam game, the hawks and the doves, but definitely moving us in the direction of the counterculture to the craziness, the Pizzagate society we have today.
Yeah, and like I said, the people laugh about, you know, people scoff at the Pizzagate, and they say it's been debunked. Of course, it hasn't been debunked. It just hasn't been proven. And these things are never proven. I don't think the Franken scandal was proven. It wasn't adjudicated because the investigator was murdered and the witnesses were thrown in jail for perjury, the victims. Technically, there weren't any victims there either because nothing happened, right, officially. The same thing regarding the Finders case, too. It was shut down mm-hmm. for the reasons of national security. So there's no victims there either. Same thing with the case out in San Francisco, with the Presidio. You know, it was covered up. But nevertheless, whether or not what actually is happening, or isn't happening at that pizzeria in Washington, D.C., these networks do exist, and you know, these a deviant elite do indulge in these things. And human trafficking is a huge problem. I think it's been exposed with the Clinton Foundation down there in Haiti. At least a lot mm-hmm. of evidence suggests that. One of the things of when you go and destabilize a country, not only are you getting access to its resources or being able to exploit its labor, you can literally create situations where people are so desperate that you can create a very lucrative market or very rich market for human trafficking, because you have a lot of orphan children and a lot of girls that are desperate. And in wartime, you know, men often turn to selling drugs and women turn to selling their bodies, or people sell their children off, whether it's for sex or for organ trafficking.
And that's part of the degradation of the human spirit, which has always been a goal of this, because we know that this is Luciferian at its heart.
Which even get Luciferianism and all this and that, when you talk about transgenderism and that, you know, you talk about it's sort of this androgynous idea, which gets back to Gnosticism, right? I think Gnosticism, feminists don't realize, is they're kind of a byproduct of Gnosticism, because I think this type of Gnosticism taught stated that the creation itself was an error.
Yeah, well, transhumanism actually goes back to well before the Gnostics that came in the wake of the first Christians. Actually goes back to the days of the Book of Enoch and the time of the flood, when you had these unions between angels and human beings.
Yes, yeah.
And there was actually mixing of species. If you go into some of the non-canonical books, like the Book of Jasher and the Book of Enoch, you see that they were actually mixing species, and it was this is a very important element in God's wrath that brought about the flood of Noah. It wasn't just that men were doing evil; it's they were actually corrupting God's creation, and one of the purposes of the flood, as I see it, was to reboot the planet and to get it back to God's original creation. So you see the danger today with transhumanism, where they're splicing genes and putting human genes into animals. They're actually reproducing the events that were provoking God to bring about the great flood. So you see that it's realistic to say that we're probably headed towards end times, just as the flood itself was a sort of end time in its own epoch.
Well, yeah, it's obviously with GMOs and genetic engineering and these things. People like Ray Kurzweil, thinking that you can upload your consciousness to a computer and live forever to become like gods.
That's out of Book of Genesis. Yeah,
yeah. And so it's the more things change, the more they stay the same. Nothing changes under the sun, right? Was it King Solomon who said that? Or
yes, in Ecclesiastes.
Yeah. So. And they never learn, and that's. And now, part of me thinks a lot of this transhumanism stuff is like alchemy. It's a kind of a con, to get billionaires to fork over cash to people like Ray Kurzweil. They want to live forever, I guess. That's part of the. How many transplants has David Rockefeller had?
He said several heart transplants, and he was at the 1957 Bilderberger meeting with Henry Kissinger. It's amazing those guys around. I kind of get the feeling that him and Kissinger, maybe Queen Elizabeth, they've been around for so long. There's a big new Brzezinski, too. Brzezinski wrote an article for Foreign Affairs in 1961. These guys are still around. I get the feeling they're waiting for something to happen. And that's another thing that suggests to me that perhaps we're close to some sort of climactic negative event.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a positive thought.
Well, ultimately, it's positive. In the short run, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there anything else? I mean, we talked about that. Is there anything in the article we missed that you want to talk about?
Well, just to bring it back to the present time, I know we've been kind of over the map today, but hopefully in a good way. I was talking about the 60s and the relationship to today. One of the things that I see, of course, is that we have these riots which are funded by billionaires. And one of the things I mentioned in my article was, you look at the rioters of today, at least the hippies had something substantial to protest, which was a war. But the rioters of today are protesting "not my president" and a remark that Trump made in a locker room about grabbing a woman's privates. Yeah. And it's like there's not much substance to the protest, but they're getting paid pretty well. And I am concerned that we're in the middle of another national divide. And that we may be on the verge of something explosive happening in America. According to Robert David Steele, former CIA case officer who's done some very good work in alt media, warning about the deep state, he says that when the weather warms up, you're going to see the Soros rioters out in great numbers. And apparently what they're going to try to do is to get rid of Donald Trump. They tried... first, they tried the riots in November. That didn't work. And then they did a recount. That didn't work. And then they had threats to the electors. And finally, they had Obama come up with a Russian hacking scheme. And now that all that's failed and he's gotten inaugurated, now they're working for impeachment. And they've even started a impeach Donald Trump PAC. There's a lot of events. My most recent blog post is about March the 15th. There's a lot of things coming up on March the 15th. The federal debt ceiling expires. You have a Federal Open Market Committee meeting where they may raise interest rates. If we had a government shutdown from the debt ceiling expiring combined with raising the interest rates, this comes on March the 15th, we could see a lot of energy given to these Soros writers who, by the way, already have a campaign going for March the 15th to deluge the White House with anti-Trump mail. And March the 15th, by the way, is also the 100th anniversary of the abdication of the Tsar, who was the Rothschild's greatest enemy. It's also the Ides of March when Caesar was assassinated. So if they're looking for a coup against Trump, the Ides of March when Caesar and the Tsar went down might be a good day to try to do it or to at least start it. So I'm concerned about the upcoming future. So I think it's a time that we need to keep in our prayers and that we need to be vigilant about.
Well, yeah, praying and being vigilant is always good advice. So, well, James, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tim. It's a pleasure talking to you. I feel that we were maybe a little bit here and there tonight, but hopefully we still had a program that will be edifying to some of your listeners in ways that they with information they haven't necessarily heard before.
Yeah, well, these conversations tend to wander because they do branch out because these things are all connected.
That's right. You know. It's hard to get every detail in exact chronological order in one conversation.
There's no substitute just for reading up on the material, so you understand you have an appreciation or understanding of our references. What we're talking about here. So, thank you. I'll let you go. Let's give your voice a rest. I know you're a little under the weather, so I really want to thank you for being a trooper and doing the interview. Hope you fully recover, and spring is coming. So I know up there it's a bit harsher than it is down here, especially this year. It's been very nice down here. Spring has sprung, so hopefully we have a nice spring and we don't have a long, hot summer with protests and riots and hopefully.
Amen to that.
So, thank you, and I'll wish you good night. And we'll talk again maybe in the near future.
Okay, great, Tim. Thank you.
So long. Good night. Bye-bye.
Sisters of the sun, rock me on the water. Oh, rock me on the water. Sisters.
Stand before the Father, but the sisters and the Son are gonna